First of all, I'm just going to ask you to say your name and the date today.
Okay.
And any other information you'd like to be presented about yourself.
Well, my name's Siri Wainwright, and today is the 2nd of April 2017. And I work for the GLC's economic, initially it was called the Economic Policy Group, and then it was called the Employment, officially it was the Industry and Employment Committee, from 82 to the abolition of the GLC in 86.
So just to start with, could you give me some information of your background before you started working for the GLC? And how you ended up in the role you ended up in?
Yes, okay, I'll give you information that's relevant to my work at the GLC. I think maybe the most relevant piece of information is that I, after my first job really, was a research job when in Durham. It was based at Durham University, and I began doing research with shop stewards in engineering. And the research was, you know, initially classic sort of sociological research about them. It was actually about their wage demands and what shaped the level of their wage demands. And then as I was interviewing them, one of them, a convener at what used to be Vickers Elswick, it's now been completely, you know, demolished. It was making armaments. Said, he's called Jim Murray, and he said, "Look, Hillary, why don't you work for us?" And he and his fellow shop stewards across the Vickers Corporation, it was a national corporation, were setting up what was called a combine committee, bringing together shop stewards from different committees in order to have stronger bargaining power with the company. And he wanted somebody, a researcher, who's got time, and I suppose as an academic I had time, that could just as well be spent working for them as for a sort of slightly abstract academic project. And my boss at Durham University was happy for me to do this. And so I ended up working as a sort of research officer, voluntarily, with this shop stewards committee. Anyway, just to cut a sort of long story short, they eventually, faced with redundancies and rationalisation, which was going on across British industry around the early mid-70s, decided in order to in order to fight this, they should begin to extend collective bargaining to look at the products they were making, what alternatives there were, you know, to get some control over investment so that they could influence the company's investment in their plant, in their factory. And that led them to, particularly given that they were making armaments, it led them to draw up, or be interested in the whole idea of an alternative plan. Meanwhile, there was another group of shop stewards at a company called Lucas Aerospace that were already embarking on such a project. So I got to know them. And the end result, after writing about the Vickers experience with a sociologist, a brilliant sociologist called Hugh Bainham, we wrote a book called The Vickers Report, and it was about shop stewards, combined committees, and responding to rationalisation. Anyway, after that, I then was sort of in touch with the Lucas shop stewards, and they wanted a researcher on actually a more elaborate scheme that provided money, research money, through the ESRC, as it is now, the Economic and Social Science Research Council, to work with them on problems they were facing with the trade union movement. So I did that, and it was based at the Open University. Anyway, as a result of that, I got very interested in both the nature of the plan and the whole idea of planning from below, sort of workers' knowledge and how it was organised and socialised, and then the political support they had from Tony Benn. In the end, that was defeated by a Labour government that became increasingly, you know, under the pressure of the CBI and the Treasury. And so it was a sort of important story that got defeated and was in danger of being lost. But many people have been influenced by it, including the chairman of our committee, our councillor, Michael Ward, who was in a way my political boss at the GLC. And he and another councillor called Val Wise, who was also very influenced by the Lucas experience, partly through her mother, Audrey Wise, who was an MP who worked with the Lucas Aerospace Shop stewards, they were really keen to kind of follow that example in London and use the GLC to give support to workers developing alternatives as an alternative to redundancy and closure and the sort of deindustrialisation of London. Anyway, they when they won the election, they set up this, you know, economic policy group, and they encouraged me and a colleague, Robin Murray, from the Conference of Socialist Economists, and who'd been based in Sussex at the Institute for Development Studies, to apply for jobs. And after the discussions I had with Robin, we thought it'd be good if I applied with Mike Cooley, who was the leader of the Lucas Aerospace Shop steward, who'd been sacked by Lucas, so he didn't have a job. So, and we thought, well, if this idea of workers' plans is going to be a crucial part of the work that we'd be doing, then why not have, you know, the most expert person doing it? So we did a joint job share application, and, you know, I didn't assume I'd get it, but we did. And so then we started work. So that's basically a slightly complicated story, but which led to me ending up at the GLC.
And the Lucas Aerospace, I've read a little bit about it. How did that have a big influence on the way in which you structured some of like the economic planning, and especially in relation to the people's plan?
Yes, I mean, it did really, because I suppose what I learned, and I think a lot of other people learned, is really the whole idea of planning, you know, raises the question of whose knowledge is relevant, you know, to planning. And the tradition on the left had been, you know, that the state really does the planning, and it's the knowledge that the state can sort of centralise, the sort of expertise that can be codified and turned into social scientific laws and be the basis of sort of planning from above, as we called it, the overview. Whereas the Lucas worker was saying, actually, we, you know, we're the people that are doing the designing, the we're the engineers, we actually know what's possible. You know, but our knowledge is not necessarily codifiable, it's not necessarily statistical, it can't necessarily be put into documents. It's things we know but can't necessarily tell. Which is what's called tacit knowledge. There's a whole body of theorization initiated by a guy called Michael Polanyi. Anyway, that's another discussion. But anyway, this whole idea of tacit knowledge or practical and experiential knowledge, which had a lot of echoes for me because of the experience of the women's movement, which also tried to share quite tacit knowledge through consciousness-raising groups and so on. So in a way, what the popular planning unit, which is what I initiated with the support of Robin and Mike Ward, was really to develop that idea and make it the basis of a different kind of economic policy, an economic policy from below, as it were. So we call it popular planning rather than workers' planning, because we knew that in London it wouldn't always be about the workplace, it would often be about communities that were under threat from speculation and, you know, office buildings being built in central London locations. You know, there are one or two classic examples like Coin Street near Waterloo, where, you know, the local people had a plan, an alternative plan. Some big corporate speculator was wanting to buy the land, and the GLC, once it was the left GLC, once it had been elected, blocked that speculative project, and instead of sort of in a classic traditional leftist way, taking over the land and planning it itself. It did take over the land, made it public, but then, as it were, shared it, handed it over, effectively, to a local community trust, which then implemented their plan with some GLC support, you know, expertise and finance and so on. So we wanted that broader idea of popular planning, but whether it was popular planning or workers planning in the workplace, it was about giving a platform to and resources to and sharing the practical and tacit knowledge of ordinary people. So it was starting from respect for that knowledge.
In these situations, but maybe with particular reference to people's plan, what was the interaction like with the local communities? Because the GLC had recently kind of got a radical manifesto, but before that the GLC was quite involved in lots of communities, maybe in very different ways. I'm just wondering about that first interaction or those moments of meeting with those communities.
Yes, it's a pity you can't interview some of the people we worked with, who sadly died, a wonderful woman called Connie Hunt, who, if you talk to her, she would really, curse the GLC historically. You know, they were up against it, they were fighting it, because it was often their landlord, and a very bad landlord. I mean, it had done some good things in terms of house building, and it had got an honourable tradition with Herbert Morrison, wanting to use municipal power to bring about a redistribution of wealth. I mean, the GLC is based on quite a big redistributional principle, because it's taking the funds of, from business rates and so on in Hampstead, let's say, and redistributing it to the people of Docklands and Tower Hamlets and Newham and the poorest areas. But, there was a wariness of the GLC, and it was important that in the Popular Planning Unit our approach was very much about directly going to meet people. So I went down to Docklands and sat in on the meetings of the people organising against the airport. So I didn't sort of go down heavy-handedly, or even sort of philanthropically saying, we've got bag loads of money, we can support whatever you want. I just sat there and listened, and then at a certain point said, sounds like, you've been thinking about alternatives to the airport as well. I'm just here to say the GLC is behind you, supports your campaign, because, the manifesto, which is like our framing document, was against any sort of airport development there, and was wanting to support some kind of local transport hub, some modest dock facility linked to rail facilities and so on, and some reprocessing. So I said this, and said, so we'd be willing to support you developing a your plan for the area, but what do you need? How do you want to do it? And then they would, then gradually we built a relationship, and Ken Livingstone came to open the People's Plan Centre, as I remember, and so in a kind of gentle, not too impositional way, the GLC rebuilt a relationship which was based on support rather than on imposition or domination.
Yeah, what are those in terms of the structure the kind of process that the People's Plan took? How was it organised? Especially coming from now, I can't imagine how that organisation would look of both, obviously in some ways very state opposition, but also still a government structure interacting on those kind of grassroots communities.
Yes, firstly, it was very much driven by them. They set up a committee, to run the process, and they asked me to be on it in some advisory capacity, at least. I'm not sure if I had a vote or not. And my approach was always to say, so what do you think, how do you think it should be done? So they first said, I think we need a place that people can come with their ideas. You know, so they were thinking very much in terms of what would it mean? Well, how would it work in terms of their knowledge of people's willingness to participate? So that was clear. They wanted somewhere that was part of people's daily lives, you know, in the shopping centre, so people could just drop in and share ideas. So that's what led to the idea of a People's Plan Centre. And this woman, Connie, she knew it was called Woolwich Pier Parade, and she knew which shops could be got cheaply. And so we rented a shop and set up this People's Plan Centre. And then they said, well, you know, we're all quite busy. I mean, these are mainly retired women, but they were busy. You know, they'd become sort of shop stewards of the area, really, as well as having their families and their grandchildren and so on. So they said, well, we ought to employ some people who could do this work for us, who could go out and stimulate ideas. So we developed a kind of idea of what we wanted. We wanted somebody who could work with local businesses, somebody who, you know, could work with young people, somebody who was more community-based. And we got, I think, four people. One was a guy who worked with businesses. Another was a young woman who just left school. And then another was a mother who was mainly based at home, but, you know, was wanting to go back to work. And the other was a young guy. I can't remember much about him. Gary, I think he's called. But he was just like a young streetwise guy. And so the committee then sort of worked with them on a plan to visit, you know, all the local kind of, you know, wherever there were people. So the guy that was responsible for contact with businesses, his job was to see whether those businesses wanted to expand, whether there's any room for expansion, and to discuss what they would need to do so. And then the young woman, she would just think of ways of contacting people. So I remember going with her to a bingo session, and halfway through said, could we, you know, have a little bit of a discussion about this? Which, you know, it wasn't her favourite idea of spending a bingo evening, but they were willing to do it. And others would organise smaller meetings in their streets and so on. So that was a sort of process that was both locally based but GLC supported, and had got some capacity to really go deeper through these people that were employed. And they would be employed at the People's Plan Centre. Sometimes most of them would be half time, I think, from what I can remember.
And what was in terms of deciding what the outcome was, how was that kind of decided in terms of like creating like an actual kind of final piece or a final presentation, and who did it get presented to?
Well, there was a bit of pressure because there was an inquiry going on into whether or not there should be an airport. You know, sort of government-backed inquiry, for which we needed to get the plan done, to present. And there was a lawyer, Tony Gifford, who was very sympathetic. He was the lawyer for the campaign. And he was very sympathetic and wanted the plan to be an important part of the campaign against the airport's sort of argument. So we had to get it ready for them. So the meetings of the campaign against the airport kind of agreed broadly what should be in it, and then I worked with, you know, different people to write it up, and then a very fantastic designer designed it with pictures that the local community had gathered, and so it was sort of done with them but also with this external expertise, both in terms of design and with me in terms of the writing.
Do you think there was an optimistic feel about it in terms of its potential of success?
Well, it was people were optimistic in the sense they felt pleased with what they'd done. I think they knew they were up against pretty tough odds. You know, the inspector was a friendly guy. But, you know, he was the employee of the government. You know, and I mean, the London Doctors Development Corporation, which was backing the airport, was a government body. So this inquiry was effectively, you know, if it was to say anything critical, it would be challenging the government. So it was sympathetic to us. The plan, the inspector went out of his way to say he appreciated it. And actually, I think it did have an impact because the end result was that the airport could go ahead, but there had to be very definite restrictions on the size and noise of jets. And, you know, so it didn't go ahead in a sort of gung-ho, anything goes kind of way.
And in terms of maybe the community and the changes that the community went through, the people's plan, but like, what changes do you feel like happened?
I don't know, it's difficult for me to say, because I didn't really sort of study that, but I suppose people did become more confident and more sure they were right, because they did feel this alternative was possible. So I think it just sort of increased people's sense of a common cause and a positive cause. I think the fact it wasn't just negative put people a bit onto the offensive.
I am very, very interested in this particular, the idea of the people's plan. And I guess in terms of what that idea of like short-term relevance, I guess in terms of community, but also in terms of kind of economic structuring and like workers' rights as because that's obviously like so present to that area. So many people have lost their jobs in like the 20 years before.
Like in the docks.
So I guess what like maybe the like short term kind of impact, but also what you might think about the longer term impact of a project that looks at economic restructuring from like grassroots level.
Well, I'm not sure that it did have much impact. It brought together the small businesses, and that could have been important. Whether it led to any of them expanding, doing more, applying for grants from the DLC or the LDDC, I'm not quite sure. I never followed that up. But that's quite likely. And then in terms of workers, it did get the support of the TNG and the workers, some of the ex-dockers gave evidence. And I think, you know, the docks had just, I think they've gone. So the jobs would more be public sector jobs, and we didn't really go into that in enough detail. Looking back, that's something we should have done. So that side of it, I mean, I think it could in any new project. I would very much urge that sort of involvement of public sector workers, because I think that's a crucial area of new jobs, and also a crucial area of improving existing jobs. But that wasn't really much of a dimension, and so I don't think there were, I can't really say that there was much impact on, you know, fighting for jobs or defending jobs, you know, that had a real impact on the nature of the jobs.
Do you feel like there's any long-term kind of impact? Or like influence?
Yes. I just don't know really. I mean, whether it had enough depth of support and participation for that to be the case in Newham. I mean, there's quite a lot of hostility to it from the politicians. Well, mainly from the civil servants who kind of thought, the people planning? That's not really acceptable. I mean, the head of planning came to the GLC and complained about the fact that the GLC put a copy of the plan, just imagine that big plan, through everybody's door, you know, which to me is a big confidence builder, cause saying, look, you know, you can do it. This isn't a council document, it's your document. And they were furious, you know, and came to the GLC and and Mike Ward, the councillor, had to summon me, and you know, I think they thought he'd give me a bollocking, but he didn't. He was just very supportive, and they had to go away with their legs between their tails, really. But I think that meant that the People's Farm was a little bit marginalised to the Docklands area, to the Royal Docks area, which is a very beleaguered sort of area. So I mean, I think it's great that this project can sort of revive it a bit.
Can you tell me a bit more about the interaction between the GMC and the council, in terms of what those interactions were like, or how often you came into contact in terms of the People's Plan, but also maybe the Popular Planning Unit in general, because there must have been some potential conflict?
Well, I think that the Docklands thing is specific because there the government had taken away the planning powers of the local authorities. So they're very sensitive. You know, they didn't want the GLC taking away their powers as well. Whereas in fact the GLC was trying to support them. But I think as a result they were a bit wary of initiatives like the People's Plan because it seemed like yet another coming from different sources sort of challenge to their authority. So I think that would be the source of the problem. And I don't think they ever overcame that. I mean, I don't think the GLC made it a priority to sort of liaise with the council. They were more concerned with developing the People's Plan. Probably there would be some councillors who would be sympathetic. I don't remember, but there were definitely some, but I don't remember exactly who. There's a woman called Pat Ollie, who I think was sympathetic, but that was quite, you know, it was a pretty conventional Labour council, quite right wing, quite wary of popular initiatives.
And was that true across projects that the Popular Planning Unit was involved with?
No, not wholly. It just depended on the council. I mean, there'd probably be some councils that would be quite sympathetic and be working with us. I don't know. Islington was quite radical at that time. Maybe we did a lot of work on childcare, and I think that in that we had a lot of liaison with local councils. So it depended on the politics of the council, because the Livingston GLC was very definitely seen as a left phenomenon. So, you know, given how fractional and divided the Labour Party can be, you know, then right-wing councils were quite hostile.
Give me some other examples, because I only really know about the Docklands one, but some other examples of other projects that had maybe an influence or similar strategies.
Well, one that involved workers, I'm not quite sure where it led to, but was around the furniture industry, you know, which is an important industry in London and was being decimated by, you know, deindustrialisation and closures and so on. And our approach there was to start firstly from the fact that we recognised workers didn't have time generally to sort of think and draw up plans and so on. And sometimes they weren't strong enough to bargain for that time, like the Lucas workers, and I think the Vickers workers did. But, you know, we're now 10 years on and workers' organisations are quite weak. And so what we did was to say, well, we've got the public funds to fund people to have time off to think. So we funded a series of workshops with furniture workers, and we got somebody, a WA tutor called Mary Davies, who'd done a lot of work with furniture workers. She was a trade union education person. And so she came and sort of helped to facilitate workshops where they discussed what was needed in the industry, you know, their alternatives, and we published that in a little pamphlet called Beneath the Veneer. But then, more important, that then had some influence on the investment of the GLC's Greater London Enterprise Board, which was there to save factories, to work with workers on alternatives and bargain with management, using the fact of money, some public money, to stop closures and redundancies. And I don't know whether that worked. We did the workshops and they worked very well, but whether it was translated into actual factories being saved. I think there were ones too, but I'm not sure it was a result of that. But certainly that was an important development.
Yeah, do you feel like the in terms of the work of the Popular Planning Unit, what wouldn't be here or what's remained?
That's a good question, but I think it's more ideas about what's possible. I think, you know, the idea of a collaboration between civil society and the state is an important legacy that wasn't really thought about before. Before, you know, the state did everything with managers, really, not with the people organised, self-organised. Even unions often didn't get a real share in thinking about planning. They were on various corporatist sort of formal bodies, but they often didn't have real influence. So I think it's more an idea that it wasn't invented by us, but we certainly developed it, of this idea of recognising the knowledge of the people. I think that's very much in Corbyn's sort of commitment. I suppose in a way that you could say that Corbyn and John McDonnell are kind of their success in the Labour Party is a kind of legacy, because in a way John McDonnell, he was like the deputy leader, and he gained from that a real knowledge of a different way of doing politics, very much in alliance with workers, with citizens, rather than a sort of the arrogance of the left. And so I think that's been crucial, but it's still got a long way to go. It's not been developed enough yet, that idea. But, you know, because of abolition, then, you know, little of our actual institutions have been able to survive. I mean, another important idea coming from Mike Cooley was the idea of opening up universities and technical, you know, polytechnics. Well, opening the universities so that inventors, technologists could work with people on their day-to-day issues facing, you know, problems of disability, problems of mobility, needing technological capacities, you know, needing inventions that would help them solve their problem. Like I said, I mean, there are a whole lot of, and he did this in practice. He started a whole lot of technology networks, you know, around green technologies, around transport technologies, and they did prototypes of things. I think a famous one was the electric bike, which I found very useful in Tuscany. I mean, not the particular one that they invented, but the idea of a bike that could, you know, move into automated gear, as it were, when it went uphill. Anyway, so that was another idea. So there are various ideas that were illustrated. The other idea that was important was the idea influenced by feminists like Sheila Robotham and others who worked with the GLC, are really saying, you know, domestic labour is a part of the economy, so our industrial strategy must include supporting childcare initiatives, laundrettes, other kinds of socialised domestic labour. So it was a very fertile sort of area where we looked at ideas that were coming up from, you know, different sort of social citizens groups, rather than just drawing them out of our own thumbs, as it were. So it was very much, you know, turning politics round. So we started with the ideas and the intelligence of local people. And so, as a result, the institutions were very open. They're very opened up in contrast to the old GLC. I mean, we had an important grant-giving strategy. So we gave grants to local groups, campaigning groups, groups with alternative ideas, groups that were working with workers who were quite precarious. So we created a sort of infrastructure of support, probably most of which has been destroyed with the abolition. I mean, the way the abolition was related a bit to the popular planning approach, in the sense that I think, like Norman Tebbit put it in a speech where, in thinking in the United States, where he said, this is modern socialism and we'll kill it. You know, and it was a different idea of the social. The social wasn't just the state, it was social collaboration and cooperation. I think maybe some of the infrastructure of the co-op movement that we supported is still around. Like, I know there's a Hackney Co-ops unit or some project, and that's still here, and obviously it's getting money from somewhere else. So the ideas like that, and also there was a very important initiative around food, looking at alternative strategies for food production that weren't totally profit driven. And the Food Commission was set up under the leadership of Tim Lang, who's now, you know, seen as a real expert on alternative approaches to food. So a lot of ideas got into the mainstream through the GLC. Equal opportunities now, you know, then it was seen as like way out. So we supported a lot of feminist projects, gay liberation projects. Police monitoring is another area that, again, is now kind of recognised widely amongst particularly black groups, but other groups who've been up against the police now recognise and realise that they could play some role in monitoring the police and then working with a sympathetic local authority to put their monitoring into practice.
Do you feel that there's been any negative outcomes from the GLC?
Well, not really. I mean, I suppose I'm biased, but I tend to feel, you know, that it was. I think the other positive thing, actually, I was thinking about this the other day, is that it was a kind of example of changing the state. You know, often people think the state can't be changed, and or it can only be changed from above. I mean, this required definitely a radical leadership. So the Livingston leadership was very open. It was never really about, you know, you have to support the Labour Party. It was very, very much more open. And it opened up the institutions of the state. You know, there was very little secrecy. All the budgets were open. All the policies were open. Sort of democratisation was very much sort of theme. So when Livingston had policies he wanted to discuss with staff or involved staff, he would convene a meeting of staff and open it up and discuss. And there was a very collaborative approach, you know, across the Labour group. So people who weren't necessarily on the left, but who supported some of these ideas would be welcomed. We also did a lot of work trying to bring the civil service on board, and also to sort of push the GLC's resources outwards to the communities rather than sort of centralise. So that was an example of reforming the state, which, you know, is obviously very needed and now is focusing around Scotland and devolution. But this is a good example of sort of opening up city government. And so I think, again, you know, it's an idea that's even more relevant now.
Do you still have, relationships with the people that you worked with? Is that something that's like come from that GLC era as well?
Yes, some of them. I mean, Connie Dye, the woman in the Docklands that I most worked with, I'm going to be doing a meeting with other people from Docklands in May. And I'm in touch with, there's a guy, Bob Colnut, from the Joint Docklands Action Group, which is very important. That was a very important ally of the People's Plan and an important support for me and the GLC, because they'd worked in Docklands for a long time. And many of them are still around, so I keep in touch with them. Mike Cooley's quite ill, but I'm sort of in touch with him and other people in the Lucas Aerospace Combine Committee. And I'm in touch with Robin Murray. So, you know, there's so a lot of ideas, a lot of people continue to sort of bubble away.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of Docklands, has that been somewhere that you've felt connected to since? And just in terms of, like, you're still going to meetings that are based around, like, stuff going on in Docklands?
Yeah, I'm not really. I mean, I suppose coming to live in Hackney takes me a bit nearer. I feel a sort of affinity to Docklands, but I haven't really had time or opportunity. I went to Connie's funeral and went to see her husband afterwards. So that I visited again. So that was quite moving. And I've met interesting sort of young architectural students who are interested in the people's plan and who either did some work in Docklands. So I've kept in touch with other people's plan, really, about interest in it. But I haven't been involved in day-to-day work in Docklands. I have to confess, I'm afraid I've used the airport. I always think I'm going to be struck by lightning or something, because we did campaign against it, and I am against it, but, you know, I do try and travel by train as much as possible in Europe, but been once or twice I've gone there. Maybe that.
You're only being recorded.
Yes, I know.
I was just wondering, when you say that you, like, so the people's plans become one of the ways that a kind of connection is still made. Who's shown interest in the people's plan since the GLC?
Well, I've had contact with quite a lot of students from the Royal College of Art who are doing theses about it, or theses that draw on it. I mean, not about it. I love. So there's a lot of interest amongst students, particularly critical architectural and planning students, who are wanting to, you know, see other ways, alternative ways that are more democratic, more responsive to social need, and for them the people's plan has been a useful stimulus and maybe inspiration, but I don't exaggerate its impact.
What would, as a last question, what would your advice be to anybody that wanted to try and do a people's plan in the future in, like, the current political situation?
I think, well, firstly, really really trust and listen to the people and work with them on ways they can share their knowledge, strengthen their knowledge. Also, look creatively at the different sources of resources, because you need time. I mean, planning, you know, is incredibly time consuming, and thinking too. And, you know, corporations pay, you know, huge amounts to pay people to think and to plan, and we need our own equivalent, so we need to find the time, the resources to do that. So recognise there is this huge untapped capacity in people's practical everyday knowledge, and work on how to share that and build on it. And then make demands on any public institutions. I mean, I suppose local authorities are being, you know, really clobbered, but there are one or two good examples of where, like in Preston, a councillor wanting to extend democratic control over the local economy has brought together all the public sector bodies and recognised the huge amount of spending that together they have that could be directed towards the local economy. And he's interested in how to democratise that through co-ops, through, you know, forms of networked organising that are made possible through the digital technologies that are now available. So there's, I think, the new technologies, without romanticising them, they do make possible a more distributed, decentralised form of production that then needs coordination. So I think always start from what's already happening. So in a lot of areas, there's lots of social initiatives, social businesses even, that, you know, could probably be stronger if they were more coordinated. So a kind of mapping of what already exists, I think, is an important starting point. So you're not just, you know, imposing some other impossible idea, but you're starting from the ways in which people are already creating alternatives in their own lives and trying to give that a platform and a greater kind of strength.
Great. Thanks so much.
Okay, sorry it's not been longer.
Oh, no.